This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The arms race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union may be winding down, but my guest James Adams warns there's a new arms race underway. As the superpowers begin laying down their arms, the developing nations are picking them up. Adams says developing nations want weapons as a symbol of power and authority, and they need weapons to fight regional wars. Weapons are in the hands of dictators, and through the black market, weapons are also going to terrorists and drug traffickers. James Adams is the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, where he's also an associate editor. His new book is called Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. According to Adams, the arms business changed dramatically during the past decade.
What is different, I think, about the last decade of this century is that you've got weapons of mass destruction, and traditionally that has meant to us nuclear weapons, but this is different, chemical, biological weapons, which are readily available through technology transfer and because they're easy to make, by and large. You have developing countries who've got access to that kind of equipment, which was never possible really before. And the worrying thing is, of course, that they not only have access to that kind of equipment, but they have delivery systems, missiles, particularly ballistic missiles, that can get them from the point of origin to the point of destination with ease, and against which there is no real defense. So it's a completely different problem, and the scale of it is unimaginable, really. Chemical weapons or biological weapons can be just absolutely devastating in their effect, and we've seen in Iran, Iraq, and elsewhere that countries are all too ready to use them if they have them, unlike nuclear weapons, which, of course, have not really been used.
Which countries are the leading suppliers in the new arms race, and what's the balance between it being supplied by governments and being supplied through the black market?
Well, I think you go into a definitional problem to some extent on actually who supplies it, because the black market traditionally means, I think, illegal supplies of weapons. And, of course, there are the arms dealers who do that. But there is the sort of grey market where countries say, we will not supply equipment X to any countries in area Y, but then secretly do so. And the grey market is an enormous and growing market. And the countries that are exploiting it are not just countries like Germany, let's say, or Switzerland or Sweden, but newcomers to the arms market who have grown up in the last decade. Countries like Brazil, North Korea, South Africa, which is now a major arms exporter, Israel also. So these are new nations where there weren't traditionally the arms business was left to the very industrialized nations who had a measure of control, I suppose. But the new competitiveness in the market is not only drives down prices and gives countries who want weapons a number of places where they can go to buy them, but makes those weapons readily accessible to places where before it would have been much more difficult for the arms to get. So it's a different world, really, now than 1990 compared with 1980 is really been transformed.
My guest is James Adams. He's the defense correspondent of the Sunday Times of London and author of the new book Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. You say that the Iran-Iraq war helped change the arms business, in part because it was such a big market, but also because there were new cheap weapons that were in demand there. This created a new market at a time when the arms market was declining?
Yes, I think that's right. Or it would be fairer to say created a new market at a time when the traditional arms suppliers were finding it difficult to meet previous levels of arms supplies. But what the Iran-Iraq war did was create a market which hadn't really existed before, and it was a huge market, a scale of unimaginable size, really, where both sides over 8 or 9 years spent around $500 billion, not just on arms, but on the war. And so countries that previously would not have had an outlet or indeed a reason for going into the arms business because they'd figure, well, we won't be able to sell what we produce, rushed to feed at the trough. So you had countries like Brazil, which at the beginning of the war were really negligible players in the arms field, South Africa the same, who produced a very wide range of weapons. So South Africa that started the war, started the Iran-Iraq war, dependent almost entirely on outside suppliers, ended the war self-sufficient in everything except for sophisticated modern jet fighters. And that was an extraordinary change of power and of influence that I don't think could have happened under any other circumstances, and has changed the whole arms market forever.
Well, 28 countries supplied both Iran and Iraq. The United States, France, China, South Africa, West Germany are just a few of those 28 countries. What do you think some of the consequences have been? Have there been consequences of 28 countries having supplied both sides?
Well, no, I don't think so, really, because we would like to think, perhaps, that this example of blatant hypocrisy, where countries sign up to boycotts and then not only ignore it by sponsoring one side, but totally ignore it by sponsoring both sides, one would like to think that some sanction would result. But it's a measure, I think, of the realpolitik of the arms business, that no one really seems to mind terribly much. And there are the ritual noises of protest made here and there, but there isn't any sanctions in the sense of a country is banned from being a member of this group or that group, or is ostracized by other countries. Instead, it is isn't this rather unfortunate, and people move on to other things. And it certainly doesn't mean that a country, having supplied both sides, is then banned from the arms fair in Singapore this year. Quite the reverse. It's done rather well and will advertise its arms as having been proven in combat. So it hopes that it will generate more sales, and probably will do so, in fact.
Iraq is trying to become a nuclear power, and they are allegedly building a supergun, a gun that would be able to fire both chemical and nuclear weapons. The person who is believed to have been the designer of this record was recently murdered. His name was Gerald Bull. Italy recently seized 90 tons of steel parts that were suspected to be part of the supergun design. Do you have any information, inside information, on the development of the supergun?
Well, Jerry Bull is an interesting guy, actually, because he was originally, he set up a company called Space Research Corporation, which was based on the border between Canada and the United States. And his original plan was to put cheap satellites in space using this enormous gun, 118 feet long. And he test-fired it using a site in the Caribbean. Now, he was originally operating with the covert support of the U.S. government. Many believe that it was the CIA who originally funded Dr. Bull, and he then fell out with them and went off on his own way, but not before he had developed a super cannon, a particular type of weapon, a 155mm with a new type of ammunition, that he then passed to Israel, which in turn passed the technology to South Africa. South Africa has built the weapon known as the G5 and has sold it to Iran in exchange for oil, has used it in Angola, and South Africa has developed perhaps the most effective mobile artillery system in use in the world today, courtesy of Dr. Bull. And he has supplied weapons to Iraq also. And then, as you mentioned, the supergun. And he was assassinated, many believe, by Israeli intelligence before the Iraqis managed to get all the equipment in hand. But he's had a very interesting career, both on the legal and covert arms market and on the illegal market, and has been a major player for some time until he was shot a couple of months ago.
Do you think that there's any way to stop new countries like Iraq from developing nuclear weapons?
I think it's extremely difficult, which is a very sort of dumb answer. But the countries that have developed nuclear weapons recently, Israel, South Africa perhaps, Pakistan, certainly very close to it now, Iraq a few years off, but proceeding along that path quite happily. All those countries have been known to be developing nuclear weapons, and other countries have, the United States or the Soviet Union or Britain or France or whomever, have signed up and said, this must stop. But at the end of the day, there are always reasons why one country or another will not hold the line and bypass the boycott that people have agreed to. So in the case of Pakistan, for example, the United States has absolutely hard, certain intelligence that Pakistan is developing nuclear weapons, that that work has proceeded, that despite Congress needing, wanting a mandate from the president that they are not developing nuclear weapons, the president keeps saying, well, they're not really, and we're not absolutely 100% sure, which is twisting the truth, to be polite about it. They do not stand and say, if Pakistan does this, we will cut off all aid to Pakistan. Instead, they say, okay, well, we don't really think it's happening, because Pakistan was needed for the United States in supplying weapons to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. So it's that kind of realpolitik that always undercuts, or seems to always undercut, efforts to stop proliferation, whether it be of nuclear or chemical or even simple conventional arms.
In your new book, Engines of War, you paint a picture of the arms race and the drug trade growing together side by side, feeding off of each other. How do they feed off of each other?
Well, if you take, for example, Afghanistan, where the supply of equipment, military equipment, to the Mujahideen was at a level unprecedented in modern times for a guerrilla war, and you take the people who the equipment was being supplied to, you have the Mujahideen are portrayed as being heroic resistance fighters, which indeed they were, very brave people, but they're also not exactly the most honest group of people you could imagine, and they saw opportunities to make a lot of money. One of the traditional ways of making cash out there is through growing opium, and so they traded much of the weapons that they had, which was a way of making money, and they then plowed that back into the economy in terms of cultivating more land, grew opium, converted it into heroin, and then shipped it, 80% of it, to the United States. So it was a strange cycle of arms for cash, for drugs, all of beginning and ending with the United States, which is a price that the U.S. is only beginning to realize it's having to pay for the support of that war.
Weren't drugs also used to buy arms?
Oh, yes, indeed. I mean, the PLO have been involved in that for a long time. The drug barons in Colombia use drug money, of course, to equip their private armies, but you would generally find that the drugs generates the cash which buys the weapons, rather than the weapons generating the cash which buys the drugs, because drugs are the profit margins on drugs are far higher than they are on arms.
Well, drug dealers are becoming big users of weapons now. I mean, two Colombian drug dealers believed to be working for the Medellin cartel were arrested trying to purchase 120 Stinger missiles and other military hardware in Florida recently. And the belief is that they were going to use these weapons against the government before the May 27th presidential elections. Is this an example? Go ahead.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, you're bound to have, where you're generating substantial sums of money and you're generating it illegally, and the money is just so enormous that one can hardly imagine the scale of it, then what you're going to do to protect your investment, which is happens to be in drugs, but it could be, I suppose, in anything, then you're going to buy arms to fuel it. And you have enough money that you can buy just about any arms you like. Now, clearly, in the case of Colombia, there's not much point in buying M48 tanks or anything. What you want is stuff that is very effective, high technology, high power, and gives you a lot of street credibility. Stinger missiles do that very precisely. So there is enough around to buy pretty much whatever you want, and the drug dealers around the world tend to have the cash in a way that really no one else has.
Where do the independent arms dealers get their arms from?
Oh, well, there's no shortage of suppliers. You could go from the arms bazaar in Peshawar in Pakistan on the border with Afghanistan. You can go to the Eastern Bloc, where traditionally both the military, senior military figures and senior political figures have made a great deal of money on the private arms market. And then you can go to other dealers like Monza Alcazar, perhaps the most significant illegal arms dealer in the world, who buys his weapons from, say, he bought a year's supply of Star pistols from the Spanish government and stored them in a warehouse in Spain and then sold them to anyone who wanted to buy them. Or you go to South Africa, who doesn't care who they sell their arms to. They're not worried whether a man is operating on behalf of a terrorist or a country, as long as they get good foreign currency for the weapons that they produce. It is only in countries like the United States and Britain where there is supposed to be a conscience attached to a rifle. For many countries, there is no regard for the end user, merely a need for cash.
Which are the countries whose economies are most dependent on arms sales?
Well, for many countries, like Britain, for example, generates several billion pounds a year from the arms business, and that is good foreign currency that comes in and has a significant effect on the balance of payments and employs, the arms industry in Britain employs over 100,000 people. Perhaps 500,000 people are employed in arms-related businesses. So it's a very significant impact on an industrial country like the United Kingdom. In a country like South Africa, where they're desperate for foreign exchange, it has a much more significant impact, because for every weapon they sell abroad, that is currency that they would not otherwise be able to obtain. And no one, they produce all sorts of equipment under license, much of it from Israel, and no one is going to say, if they're selling equipment to Brazil or Venezuela or something, no one is going to say, I won't buy this because it's from South Africa, which they might say if they were buying fruit or other items, because the arms business isn't really afflicted with the same conscience. And so for countries like that, the arms exports can be very significant indeed. And for a country like Brazil, it can be perhaps the most significant export apart from coffee.
Well, that's bad news. I mean, in the sense that it's difficult to imagine de-accelerating this new arms race if so many governments have economies that are dependent on selling arms.
I think that that's true, and it's one of the ironic byproducts of better relations between the superpowers, that while they are destroying weapons and throwing away missiles and reducing numbers of troops, the equipment that they would normally use is going to come onto the market, and I do not believe it'll all just be destroyed. Instead, they will go out into other markets, and those other markets in turn will sell on their equipment. So you're going to have a much more competitive environment where prices will fall, where there will, if you like, be a constant yard sale of military equipment around the world. And that in turn is going to help with the proliferation. So you have two pressures: one, the new arms suppliers themselves, and two, a greater number of arms from a greater number of countries, all competing for, by and large, the same markets. So all of that seems to suggest that there will be a large number of countries be able to have more and better weapons than they've ever had in the past.
Would you have any suggestions for reversing that trend?
I think it's extremely difficult, because there are a number of things that one can do: tighten up the nuclear proliferation, non-proliferation treaty, have a chemical treaty, but all of these things only work if there are real sanctions. And sanctions in the past have never, ever worked effectively, because each country that sees a possibility of earning some cash will just ignore any agreements that they've signed. So there has to be agreements agreed to and then sanctions applied. And if this country ignores the agreement, then there has to be serious penalties applied. And realistically, I don't see that actually happening. Who is going to say to Germany, because you supplied the equipment that has allowed Libya to develop a chemical weapons manufacturing capability, you can no longer sit at the table where trade is discussed? Well, that's just simply not going to happen. You can have a public opprobrium. You can have exposing it to the public. That does some good, but only for a very short time.
As a journalist, your beat is stuff that's highly secretive. You know, arms merchants, governments that don't want it known that they're building nuclear weapons, governments that don't want too many people to know how much they're exporting in terms of weapons. What's the most difficult thing about getting to the bottom of things in your job?
Well, I think the most difficult thing is getting the trust of all different parties who are involved, from the intelligence community through the arms dealers, through governments. It's extremely difficult getting people to talk about things that are, as you say, secret. I think what you have to do is to talk. You don't talk to the Iraqis about what the Iraqis are doing. You talk perhaps to the Americans or to the Brits. But then you wouldn't talk perhaps to some people in America about what the CIA are doing. You might talk to the Brits or the French. So one has to some extent to trade off one against the other, rather like the arms business itself, perhaps.
Well, James Adams, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Adams is the defense correspondent and associate editor of the Sunday Times of London. His new book is called Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.